Okay, so concerning the assignment, we're going to hand it back. We have not made photocopies. Anybody who wants to argue about their score is welcome to do so, but given where the scores were, the scores can only go down, so I don't recommend it, because everybody got it right. And frankly, the purpose of it was to force you to dig into the code and just see what the heck was there. And, you know, maybe puzzle a little bit over spin logs. Some of you, of course, were more puzzled than others. I'm pleased to say, actually, nobody was terribly puzzled. So I want to try to address something that was more confusing in the code than it is now. And I also want to thank the person who sent me the question, where does should defer get cleared? Because the answer is, oops. Not only were we failing to clear it, but in the course of inserting that, I stared at the code again and said, wait a minute, this code is just wrong. And I'll tell you why. Not wrong in a fatal way, wrong in a way that sort of would have recovered itself, which is almost worse. These, you know, bugs that are self-masking are extra special to find. Dependent of that, there were some changes in the code base, and I want to tell you about a trick that we were using that was so clever that we decided to take it out. It had been the case that if you had looked in the right places in the code, you would have found something of the form declare per CPU followed by a type and a name. Elsewhere, you would have found a corresponding define per CPU. This is no longer there. Or if it is, it's vestigial. What this macro was doing was using a feature of GCC to say, put this variable in a different section than the binary. So if you really dug deep, and there was no reason for you to have done so, the traditional binary has code, data, and BSS, and if you had really dug in, okay, it probably doesn't matter. If you had really dug deep, you would have discovered in the linker file, on the linker script, something like, I don't remember what it was exactly called, data.per CPU. And the idea was that this macro hack caused all of these per CPU variables to get gathered in the binary image into a separate place, and the binary image knew where the linker script automatically inserted the start and the end of that region, and that gave us just enough of a hook to make a copy of that region when we were starting the next CPU. The advantage to this strategy is that you don't have to know in advance what all of the per CPU stuff is going to be. If you add a new source file and you need a variable that is private to that CPU, you can just declare it this way, you know, and the linker will be your friend. Linkers are almost never your friend. They are at best your obedient servant. And, you know, lightly on the obedient part. This was just more hassle than it was worth, because the downside of that is now you got to go grepping through all the code to figure out what all the CPU private stuff is. It turned out we didn't have that many CPU private things, and one of them wasn't necessary at all. We had the cur CPU point array, and that one's very curious, and I'll explain why in a minute. It turns out that one can't use this mechanism very effectively. We had the current pointer, right? Because you have to know for your CPU what process is currently on your CPU. And then we had something called the null target cap. The null target cap exists for the sole purpose of having something to assign when there's really nothing you wanted to assign. Right? It's a write-only variable. And it exists so that we don't have to do null pointer checks when we're doing capability assignments. I think that's the only practical use I've ever seen of a write-only variable. Now, sometimes fighting City Hall is not the right solution, and we just moved all this stuff into the CPU structure. We did that last week. If you're trying to figure out where the CPU-specific elements were, at the time you did the assignment, it was basically the stuff in the CPU structure for use your CPU plus this other stuff, right? So there was this weird kind of unresolved mix of idiom that you had to sort through, and that's just gone. It's now all in the CPU structure with one exception. The exception is the per CPU variable. And the pattern in the old code, and it was purely so that we could make it visible which variables were CPU local, was that you would wrap these funny per CPU variables in my CPU. And all this did was muddle with a name. It was just an error checking mechanism. What we ultimately want is something where we can have some pointer that points to some piece of storage, and that piece of storage holds the data that I need for my particular CPU. So the data is now in the CPU structure, which is where you presumably would have expected it to be in the first place. About the pointer value. The pointer value can't live in the CPU structure. This would lead us to a certain reductio. If only I knew where the CPU structure was, I could find out where the CPU structure was. So this pointer is one that we have to get by some other form of devious magic. On many later designs, there are actually registers in the hardware that exist for this sole purpose. There's a register you can fetch that says either, here's a word that's local to my CPU and I can get it, or let me get the ID of my CPU, which has previously been stored. On the Pentium, there is actually a way to do that on later machines. It's not so straightforward on earlier machines, and it's not by any stretch of the imagination fast, because it involves a memory reference that's actually going to a hardware register, and there's sort of lash up and bubblegum and bailing wire in the middle of all that. So there's sort of two standard tricks that people use, one of which is Pentium specific, and the other of which is general, but prepare to hear your Java instructor scream. The first one, which is Pentium specific, is to say, what I'll do is I will arrange to have a segment that is specific to the CPU. At the time that I start the CPUs, I will load each CPU with a separate segment table. And, you know, entry number 8 will be the one that tells me where the per CPU data went, some value of 8. It'll be 8 on every processor, but when I load segment 8, I'll get different answers, and that's how I'll find out where my CPU data went. Typically, the way you deal with that is you actually only put one word out there, and the one word that you put out there is the pointer that you actually wanted in the first place. This, by the way, is how, it's actually 4 words, but this is basically how user-level thread local storage is implemented. It's the same trick we use. So if you look at how that's done on a Pentium machine, and actually on a IA64 machine as well, an IA32E machine, what you'll discover is that on the 64-bit versions of the Pentium, there are 2 segment registers left, FS and GS. The others exist, but they're only implemented in the most trivial sense. Why FS and GS? Because Windows and Linux don't agree about which one to use, so what the hell, we'll do both of them. What do they exist for? Because just like in the kernel, I need access to per CPU storage, in a multi-threaded application, I need access to per thread storage. So each thread in its process state contrives to load a different GS value or a different FS value, depending on whether we're on Unix or Windows, and then it reaches through that to figure out where the rest of the per thread data is. And there's some nice write-ups, actually, about how in sort of the ELF image loading model, thread local storage works, and there are 2 strategies, the clean one and the one that gets used, which is unfortunate. The other trick you can use, this one is much easier to do in the kernel than it is to do in applications, because in kernels we have the advantage that we know a bound on stack size. Because, remember you had to memorize your powers of 2. We will declare, as designers, we get to make certain fiat declarations, that the stack will always be a power of 2 in size. Be less? Tough. And it will be of the form 2 to the k bytes, okay, and it will appear at a 2 to the k alignment boundary. In reality, Facts are always some multiple of pages. So what we're saying is it's going to be an even, it's going to be a power of 2 of pages. And in the current kernel, the magical power of 2 turns out to be 1, but there's nothing magical about that. Now, why would we want to do that? Well, you know, the stack pointer is somewhere within this page. You're shaking your head no, we don't know that. You're actually right, we don't know that. We hope like hell that it's true. And I'll come back to that, because we had a bug related to this. We hope like hell that the stack pointer falls somewhere within this region. Now, why do we want a power of 2? Because we're going to use a truly disgusting overlay structure. Guess where we're going to put the current pointer? The last word of the stack page. Better hope you really do know how deep your stack is. Now your Java instructor is now screaming. I really enjoy making them do that, just for the record. And basically what you do is you grab the value of the stack pointer and you mask it by that. And the reason that works is page size is a power of 2. If you find a piece of hardware in which page size is not a power of 2, call me, because we can then get on a conference call and we can call up the architect and tell them what an idiot they are. I haven't actually seen one of those. That's not true. I actually invented one of those. When I taught computer architecture at University of Pennsylvania, people teaching courses get wild ideas that they somehow decide are important. You may have noticed this. In my case, I decided that dealing with compatibility issues and trying to sort of drive that point home that C is not a good choice for a compatible programming language, I decided that I would invent a machine for the sole purpose of illustrating how bad C is for writing compatible programs. This was a trinary machine. Yeah, think about that. And it went on from there. Since that's not our agenda this year, I simulate having outgrown that, so I'm going to let that go. Anyway, page size is a constant, right? So we can compute this whole thing in advance. We can mask the stack pointer value. And by masking the stack pointer value, we can get the pointer to this base thing in a single instruction. And having gotten that pointer, we can then dereference it to get the current pointer. Okay, and the current pointer in the Coyotes case is going to point to the CPU structure, which, if I'm going to stick to my conventions, I should label outside the structure. That's how we find it. Now, there's the catch. This assumes that you estimated the maximal stack depth correctly. Good ways to fail to do that. Use qsort. You notice that qsort is no longer in the code base. Now use heapsort. Okay, anybody want to take a cut at why qsort would be a good way to get this wrong? I'll give you, I don't know if this will turn out to be a useful hint or not. We had a case where we were q-sorting a vector of 20,000 elements. I don't think it's quite that bad. Believe it's log of that number.
Maybe not log.
Believe it's log of that. Yes. And do you happen to know under what conditions the worst case is reliably triggered when you have exactly one element in the wrong position? Now, how many times were you planning to insert more than one element into a list? Right. This is not the right choice of algorithm, right? Particularly given that I'll get there. Particularly given that we don't care what the performance of the initial to first order. We don't care what the performance of the initial sort is at boot up time. Because 20,000 elements in absolute terms just isn't that big. Yeah.
Why don't you use a qsort that doesn't use the dumb pivot element?
That might work. That would be called heapsort. Heapsort basically works by navigating its way down to a certain size and then doing an in-place sort. Which is, in fact, the sort that we're now using. So we took this 20,000 element array, and we gleefully recursed log 2 of that, whatever that works out to be. I'm not even going to try. And guess where we ended up? Well, unless you had dug into that yucky linker script, you don't know how to answer that, but I'll tell you that what's in that yucky linker script is the stack page, the CPU 0, a page directory, what is mislabeled the CPU 0 page table. We do end up with another more page table than that, but that's the bootstrap page table. And I might have the order of these reversed. Guess what happened when the stack overflowed? I suppose those words went. Whoa. But what was underneath the stack, folks? Okay, how many people have English as a third language? How many people are having serious glare problems seeing what I put on the board? Excellent, we got 2 and 1. Okay, so all of you know the answer where it went right off the end of the stack. So how many people still feel like talking today? Everybody got you raising your hand. How many people just aren't going to respond no matter what question I ask? Alright, and now what do you suppose we saw after we scribbled data on the primary page table? Advertising! From the BIOS vendor! Right? Because very quickly we scribbled over the page table that was mapping the kernel code, and it was downhill from there, but not very far downhill. Or perhaps very far downhill, depending on your point of view, but very rapidly. Gravity sucks. Okay. So you don't want to do this. But I have been debating, because this is one of those errors that's extremely hard to catch, right? The symptom is really helpful. Well, I have been debating altering the mappings so that whatever sits here, and it actually could be the CPU zero page table, because it turns out we don't really have to write it at this address. We can use the transmap to manipulate it, and there are reasons to want to do that anyway. So I've been thinking, hey, put the CPU zero page table up one, right? Just rotate the page table in the page directory. And at this virtual address, map it read-only, which is good enough for the TLB to read it. We'll have the property that when we write the bad word, we will immediately take a page fault. But I'm thinking this may not help, because the TLB, in some cases, does write data back, and so the mapping may need to be writable. It will be interesting to check whether the mapping permissions are actually even honored in that case. It would not surprise me to discover that they took shortcuts. This is just one of those perverse uses of the system that nobody will have considered. But worse, so we go to write there, we take a page fault. What does the machine do? It pushes a new stack frame. Where does that stack frame go? So what we're going to end up with is a triple fault. The reason this is worth considering is that on the Pentium there actually is a whole other layer of stuff that we could use, so that in the triple fault case we could basically move everything over to a different stack so that we could at least see that it happened. Obviously not something worth paying for in production mode, because if you manage to ship this bug into the field, you're already, you failed the altitude test. But the cause of this symptom is obscure enough that it might actually be worth the effort. By the way, this ugliness of how do I find the current CPU or the current thread exists on all architectures, and its resolution always involves a kludge of this form, or some variant of this. There are no nice solutions to this problem.
Why?
Because the early hardware designers didn't think about the issue. I basically need some register on my CPU that I can load when I dispatch your process, from which I can get a value that's unique to that CPU. And on the MIPS processors, there actually is such a register for precisely this purpose, because the designers were considering multiprocessor things when they designed the processor. I can assure you that when the 8086 was designed, that was not on the horizon. To the point when the 4040 was designed, that wasn't on the horizon. You laugh, but there is actually backwards compatibility almost going back that far in a lot of architectural common GORP. I don't know what the state is on processors that sort of came up in the middle, like the 68000 family. I just haven't, and I need to go find out, because I need to go deal with one of those. But my impression is that over time, those have added other registers and sort of addressed this issue, if you'll pardon the pun. On the x86, we need to do some measurements. So there is a register on the local APIC, which is on the same chip as the CPU, and is mapped at a known physical address, from which an ID that is unique to your CPU can be read. Now, that ID can be programmed, so you could set it to correspond to the software's notion of what the current CPU is. And then the question would be just, is that actually the most efficient way to get the number? Because you hit this a lot. And I don't happen to know what the answer is. I know that the Linux folks went back and forth on this a couple of times, and they have actually switched mechanisms a couple of times. And they've converged back on this stack mechanism, because, Two instructions with one memory reference is just tough to beat. What's that? If it ain't broke, why fix it? Right. So on the mutex thing, some people were wondering where in the process state should the fermite be found? And it isn't in the process state. It's in the processor state. This is the place where the multiplexing that implements multitasking happens. So there is a unholy alliance, perhaps we might politely call it an association, between the processor and the process. And until sequence of control of code flow in the kernel calls one of those yield mechanisms that gives up the CPU, right, the transaction abandoning mechanisms, or the transaction restarting mechanisms, the association between the process and its CPU is a stable association. Question there, Brock?
No.
Okay. There is a catch with that. One of the corner cases, suppose I want to fetch the register set of your process. I'm a debugger. I want to do a get registers. What happens that your process is now running? What should the operation do? One reasonable answer is stupid. If you want a convincing register image, you got to stop the process. I don't like that answer, but probably just because I'm biased, because we did it the other way 20 years ago. The other way, the second possible option, this is the ptrace option, give back sort of scrambled bits. It really doesn't matter if the bits are right. This is not the answer you want if you're running a debugger, and that feature was later repaired. Third is to say, look, what it means to fetch registers on a running process is that we will instantaneously halt the process, grab the register set, and then release it to do whatever it's going to do. And I don't, you know, don't ask me exactly where the process was, but I know what it was doing. Actually, I do know where it was. Except that in a multiprocessor, the process could be on some other CPU. The interprocessor, this is always easy, because if you're asking, the process you're asking about is not on the CPU. Unless, of course, you're asking about yourself, which is an interesting reductio issue that debuggers have to solve. You can talk to the registrar, there's to register. Well, you won't get any credit if you don't register, Peter.
I don't need credit, I just need your wisdom.
You were in the wrong place, dude. for any wisdom out of me. Okay. In the self-processor case, on a single processor self-debugging case, it turns out there's an escape hatch. And the escape hatch is the very first thing you want to do on your way into the kernel is save your register set anyway. And you're actually not going to see that saved copy change by this operation, because notice that get registers is an accessor operation. Okay. So the resolution of that problem is to say, well, we'll just define precisely what was the interstice at which the snapshot happens, and we will define it in such a way that the register set that we saved is, haha, conveniently the one that we're going to return. In the cross-processor case, there's an issue. If the process I'm going after is not on the CPU, good. I will grab its lock, and then it is not going anywhere. If you have a lock, you don't go anywhere without a bagel. Oh, come on. I've already established that you guys are not going to volunteer no matter what question I ask, but, you know, give me a break. But once I get the lock, I'm good. It is awkward to grab a lock on a process that is currently executing, because logically what the lock means is the state of this data structure is not going to change. I mean, perhaps I'll make an exception that there may be, you know, some fields like hash linkages that won't be governed by the lock on the object. For example, in our case, most of the fields of a process are actually governed by the process lock, but the next pointer that's associated with the object hash table is not. That's governed by the appropriate object hash table bucket lock. But at least for each field, there's a well-defined lock to blame. Okay, so the idea is, if I have the lock on the process, it shouldn't be changing. Or at least it shouldn't be changing for any cause other than I'm editing. A process that is running is, by definition, changing. If you can figure out how to execute an instruction without altering the state of the machine, let me know. So it's logically inconsistent that we would lock a process that's actually running, at best. The answer is, who cares? this might be one of these cases where the devil in the details can be ignored, but it turns out not to be one of those cases, because I promise you, if you lock that process, the next thing that will happen is it will come screaming into the kernel and it will say, I'd like to save my state. That is an edit. And in order to do that, it will attempt to grab a lock on itself. And it will fail because you've got it. And now we have an interesting puzzlement. So the rule is you cannot lock a process that is currently on the CPU unless it's you. In fact, merely being on CPU gives you a certain implicit lock of yourself. This, by the way, is one of these places where there's a very awkward reductio in every multiprocessor system I know about. We're sneaking up on it right now. So the problem is I want to fetch the other guy's registers, but he's on CPU. And so the only way I can do that is to gronk his CPU over the head and kick him off the CPU, at least for a moment, and then let him proceed. The way you do this is you set up a very delicate dance, okay, in which basically there's a mechanism called an interprocessor interrupt. Interrupt processor interrupt goes like this. You take a straw, you wad up a little piece of paper, you point the straw. You don't think it works like this?
Very tiny straw.
Okay, what's that?
It's a very tiny straw.
Very tiny straw, okay. And the other CPU says, what? And at this point, what you did was before you whacked the other guy with a spitball, okay, you sent him a note. Okay, this is like when you were in elementary school and you passed notes in class that says, I want you to, whatever process you're running, I want it to stop. I want it off the CPU because I need to migrate it into a state where I can get the lock. There are several designs for this, and all of them involve delicate dances because they involve race conditions, and those race conditions have to resolve themselves. I haven't forgot that I will come back to should defer and why it was busted because there was a race condition there. So basically, this is the cross-processor case, and the only way to resolve it is to take a hammer or a spitball or, you know, whatever your metaphor of choice is for the day. My son is fond of baseballs. And whack the other processor over the head and say, give me your attention, or rather, don't give that thing your attention because I need to grab it. And then you grab your registers, and then you stick it back in the ready queue. Of course, one of the interesting little dances here is I'm coming off of the ready queue, I'm trying to go onto my processor, and somebody tries to grab me at just the wrong moment. So there's an interesting set of locking issues in what locks exactly do I have to hold and what locks must I not hold in order to take a process off the ready queue and get it running, and I will take that up another day. So that one was fun. That one, by the way, it took us 2 solid weeks to be convinced that we had a viable design for. And having arrived at a viable design, we then went to implement it, and 3 weeks later discovered it was busted, which is why there is no longer that other lock type in the code, although there's still a vestigial reference to it. You've noticed that the mutex word reserves a 2-bit field for the lock type when the only possible values are 0 and 1. This is an edit error. So, okay, I think I'm going to stop with interprocessor interrupts. Except to say, interprocessor interrupts are so delicate that there's a strong incentive to minimize the number of them that you have to issue. Ideally, you'd like it to be the case that the mere fact that I kicked your processor in the head already tells it what it ought to be doing. If there are like 3 reasons to kick you in the head, I need to buy more boots so that you'll recognize the imprint on your forehead. I don't think it really works that way. Trust is so dead in education, really. Okay. So, and that's good, because we've already established that you should question anything I say. Good. Let me go back to should defer. I'm going to up code on this one. All right, so what was going on was as follows. I had 2 algorithms running, and this was not obvious at the time that you did the homework, because should defer was not getting clear. It was the addition of the code to clear it that made me see this error. And it's just a great illustration of why concurrency is bad for you. So fetch. So we've got mutex grab. And mutex grab is in a loop of the form mutex try lock. Now, with an infinite number of excuses. And then a bunch of code that says, well, you know, what are all the reasons that I should give up? Followed by, if I'm more important than you, like I think I'm George Bush, then your CPU should defer to true. Those of you who are looking at the current file will not find that line. It's not there anymore. Elsewhere in the story, many files away, a TV station broadcast locally in your area, there was some code that went something like, my CPU hot mutex value, all surrounded by inkgen. And this is incrementing the generation number in the lock word atomic, and this is the act that causes my CPU to implicitly give up all of its locks, because once the generation number doesn't match, any held locks will automatically get invalidated by whoever wants them, right? Go through that. So, and then, you know, the missing line that one of you thankfully kindly caught for me was my CPU defer equals false. Now, good question. What about the race condition? Why is it correct to set should defer to false here? Why is this the right sequence? Ignoring the race condition, why is this sort of the logic that we should be attempting to do?
Yes.
So having incremented our generation, kind of 60s song now, but never mind. Okay. We're done talking about our generation. Now that we're done talking about our generation, you know, our reason for stop talking has expired. Except it doesn't work. Okay. So conceptually, that's the right answer. The mechanism is broken, and it's broken in a way that modulo substitution of variable names appears on one of the slides that I teach in the first year operating systems course. Which is why when I looked at this and said, oops, what's the problem? We're talking about events that may be transpiring some, more or less simultaneously on two different CPUs. The first part of the problem is we may not manipulate should defer using non-atomic operations. We have to put in atomic operations because you could have a write here and a write there at the same time. And there's also a read, by the way, in that loop, because we only set should defer if it is not already set. That code also changed because the goal is to have it set, so there's no point checking whether it's set. It's got to be done with an atomic operation, or what you get is scrambled bits. These are not nearly as tasty as scrambled eggs. Also make a much bigger mess when you spill them if they're not done yet. All right, can somebody walk me through the sequence of operations in which should defer will get set incorrectly? At least one of the sequences of operations? No, you can, so stay out of it. Give me a hint. Got two code paths happening on separate CPUs, and the only guarantee you have is that the respective CPUs will perform their steps in order. Let me give it a try. Oh, and they're all atomic, so there will be some total ordering on these operations. Problem is, which one? Do you want to give it a try? You took an intro OS course. Or you took my intro OS course. All of your grades have just been lowered a point. I'll talk to the registrar later, because you saw this slide, for God's sake. Come on, give it a shot. Don't worry, I'll put them back next week. Peter, I want you to know, you walked in, you weren't here, you know, for the screaming Java instructors part that I think you really would have enjoyed.
Me?
What's that?
Is that instructor me?
It could be if you want.
I hope it's not.
I still think you would have enjoyed it. Okay, look, if you're trying to work out a concurrency bug, right, pick an operation and say that one happens first. So, pick an operation. Which one's going to happen first? Let's just pick one. Is it going to be the try to grab, or is it going to be the inkgen? One of those is going to happen before the other, I promise. Because we're doing atomic operations, the universe is a very sequential place. So pick one. Come on, take a risk here. Okay, so we're going to try this first. Good. Operation is going to be second. Give me a hint, it's not trigram. Okay. Well, let me rephrase the question. Which are the candidate operations that might be second? One of them is certainly inkgen. The other one's what, Brock? Is the set of should defer. You don't know which one, it will certainly be one of those. So the proposal was we're going to pick inkgen. You've just eliminated half of the useless options to evaluate. So you're on the trail of the bad case. What's going to happen next? What are the candidates? Give you another hint. It's not inkgen.
If you set bishop for false.
I gotta ask this, and this is totally politically incorrect, but since I actually know the answer, how many of you have both a left hand and a right hand? Anybody not? Good. Is anybody not sure? Of course. Come on, we've got two choices left. It's like, pick one. Come on. Yes, I will abuse you for it, but I'm an equal opportunity abuser. Okay, so the proposal is, let's try the thought experiment that this one happens next, which is indeed the case that was not considered. Okay, now does anybody want to take a really risky one on what operation happens next? Want to take the risk, or do you want to tell me what operation happens? Can I buy you a vowel?
I was going to say inkjet, but...
Get some locks. Trying to acquire a lock. Okay, I'll stop with the Jewish jokes. What's this guy doing? He's giving up the lock. We are done. Patch low, clean up. What's he doing here? It's saying, and I have given up the lock. But it wasn't enough to do it, right? We have to declare that we've done it, right? In the next year with my son, it will be, I'm really telling the truth now, right? He'll go through that phase. And what's this guy doing? Saying, I need the lock, damn it! Of course, he already has. And this is sitting in a loop. Not only does he have it, he's with high likelihood going to get it next time through the loop. You see why this protocol doesn't work? The classic concurrency error. In your favorite textbook, swap the variable names. You can find this example. And the beauty of examples like this, the reason they're examples in textbooks, is that they're so reliably reproducible. As we just saw. And this proposal was accepted by somebody who has spent the last 7 years working on a high concurrency kernel, right, in the most central, most trusted kernel design group at Sun. That should not be taken as an indictment of Solaris, although it could have been heard that way. That was not my intention. Actually, that group is very, very good. Really hard. The beauty of these errors, right, is they're right in front of you, right? They all happen in like 15 different files. You have to consider effects in two different places and in lines of code that actually are interrelated but not obviously there. So it turns out there's a fix. And the fix is, in this case, and this is sort of the pattern you want to look for to resolve this class of concurrency error, instead of saying, get out of my way, say, I should get out of my way. What do I mean by that? The things that I got back from mutex try grab was the current lock value, okay? Which is this proc mutex value of the current holder. That's what proc mutex value is for. In fact, I used it to extract the CPU ID of this guy. So instead of saying, get out of my way, what I should say is, if you are still running the following transaction ID, get out of my way. And the way to go about that is instead of setting true to this variable, just write the offending transaction ID, one that's in my way, because the goal is to clear that transaction. And then this is zero. I do not currently hold any transactions that could possibly be in anybody's way because I just gave them up. Now, did this change the race? Can the race still happen? Because this is the really important part of this. Can the race still happen? Do I do anything here that alters the race? And should defer still end up with a non-zero value? But I should say, if the lock is held, I'm going to store the old lock value, which is the transaction ID, right? So if the lock is held, we know that's non-zero. Does anything happen here to change the race? Then I get a non-zero value in should defer in this revised start. Okay to think about it, but I can and will outlive you. Also, of course you can.
Actually, that guy old log.
No old log is non-zero.
It's non-zero. So that guy can tell this guy to get out of the way, but he has already released the...
So the question is, can I end up, when all this is done, in a situation where the value of should defer is not zero?
Right?
Yeah, but I don't need a cosmic ray for this. Same order of operations I did before. And all I did, I mean, false was zero, right? So this sequence didn't change a bit. All I did was substitute a non-zero value for true. This code sequence is just as racy screwed up as it was before.
You say that that last step was a compare and swap, like atomic?
This step here?
It's not?
No, it's an atomic store. And even if it was a compare and swap, it actually wouldn't help. It would just be more expensive. Okay, so I can still get a non-zero value. Why is that now okay?
I think because you're going to try to graph lock to see if you can get...
I wasn't trying to put you on the spot. I thought you had your hand up.
I did.
Okay.
I got confused.
That's okay.
But I think what
it's... It's very evident. So did I.
I think you're going to check the... to defer against the current process ID when you decide...
Yes. The loop surrounding this is saying, if I can't get the lock, right, there's a line in the middle that you guys all stared at when you did the assignment. If I have been asked to defer, bail on the whole activity. Now, that test is just as broken as it was before. But the change is, and I am engaging in some backward shortening, both of these accesses are done with atomic reads. Why does that edit change everything? I'm sorry. The old one said, if my CPU should defer, okay? And the new one says, if my CPU should defer is equal to my CPU proc mutex value, which is the current transaction. Why does that change everything? But not necessarily. You're grubbing in the right place, but that's not correct. And the clue is, we've only added reads of variables. Adding reads of variables can never change the results of writes. So if we could get a non-zero value before, we can certainly get a non-zero value now. But you're hunting in the right place. Unfortunately, this is one of these cases where the missing keys actually are under the lamppost. What did the inkgen do? It took us from the old transaction value to some new transaction value. I don't know what the new value is, but I know it's not the same as the old one. I actually do know what the new value is, but it doesn't matter. This stored a should defer. Which value did it store? The old value. What does this compare do if should defer ends up non-zero? Nothing. Right? This compare is saying, if we are still running the old transaction, we should get out of the way. But we've declared that we're no longer running the old transaction. In fact, this set to zero could now be removed. The only reason to put it there is for a certain kind of cleanliness and documentation. This was tricky. Part of this is, and in particular, if you went through an introductory OS course, evolution broke every rule of what you were taught was the right way to think about locks. Because the conventional presentation of concurrency says races are bad, and the goal is to eliminate them. Reality is, races exist, and the goal is not to lose in them. Every semaphore implementation has a race at the bottom. It's the compare and swap operation that's almost universally used to implement those things. Nobody worries about fairness in that operation because the cost of imposing fairness is higher than the cost of living with it. The goal wasn't to get rid of the race. The goal was to make sure that in the case that the race occurred, it couldn't hurt you. And the solution for guaranteeing that it didn't hurt you was to do some value analysis and to use not true and false, but the choice of a specific value not matching. What we effectively did here in some sense was invert the true and false, because before the test was for one, and now the test in a certain sense is for not match. So, follow-up homework question. Go out tonight officially. Whoops. That would have been the follow-up homework question if it wasn't for the fact that the comment answering it was sitting right above the relevant line. In the middle of that loop, what's that? Is priority manipulation, right? Now you notice priority manipulation is not being done in a way that respects the race. You can get the wrong answer. And specifically, you can get the wrong answer if the processor is, the other CPU is in the middle of going away and is about to alter its priority. But if that happens, you'll end up going through the loop again and recovering. So, the answer to where it should defer cleared is, well, it wasn't. Actually, it doesn't need to be. The should defer logic was wrong and needed to be fixed. The reason I wanted to walk through it is, you know, here's a case that in sum total, we're talking in the mutex code about 15 lines, something like that. I mean, yeah, you had to find it, right? But basically, we were talking about less than 15 lines. Much of which was irrelevant to the problem at hand. The meat of the problem was 4 or 5 lines, depending on how you want to count it, right? It was this call to mutex trigrab, it was this assignment, it was the test in the middle, and it was the clear over here. And maybe the zeroing over here, right? It was 4 or 5 lines. And 25 of us looked at it, including me. We all got it wrong. Next time somebody talks to you about code inspection, the next time you hear Eric Raymond say that all bugs are shallow with enough eyeballs, you remember this experience. There's a technical term for the many eyeballs hypothesis. The technical term is bullshit. Bugs are shallow only if the eyes doing the looking are fully awake, knowledgeable, focused, and thinking about the problem the right way. Now, out of 1 million people reading the Linux code base, how many does that leave? The author of the code, maybe, and it's certainly true that many bugs are shallow if they're looked at with enough eyeballs, but some bugs are really subtle no matter how many eyeballs look at them. Concurrency bugs, unfortunately, are universally in that category. And I would say more generally, just as a pattern, any bug where to see what's going on, you have to analyze and sort of combine in your head behavior that's happening in multiple places, but you can't obviously get all in front of you at the same time. These bugs qualitatively are hard to understand. Humans are really good at looking at things that are linear. They're not, without significant training, they're not real good at looking at interaction patterns of this sort. This is why code is hard. I'm not trying to indict anybody. And I will go out for a beer again no matter how many times I say he's engaging in bullshit, because, you know, we enjoy doing that. But on that point, he's just wrong. And he insists that I'm wrong as well, so it's, you know, it's fair. Okay. I had promised a project assignment for this course. I don't know when I'm actually going to kick it into motion. I hope to do it this week. It depends on a change that has to get made in the kernel so that the thing can be done at all. It's not a big change. It's a question of getting to it. But what I'm going to do for the first project is have you folks implement a serial driver and line discipline module. At the bottom, and I will write this up and it will go out on the course mailing list, but at the bottom, a serial driver is not a difficult beast to implement. There's a chip down there, and it has a couple of registers, and you poke it in the side a couple of times and say, here's how fast I want you to go, and you know, here's some information like stop bits, which frankly aren't terribly important unless you were interested in implementing code for 1950. So everybody now agrees on the right answers. And then there are registers where you basically say, give me the next byte, and another register where you say, okay, here's a byte that should go out to the terminal. Very complicated protocol. And then there's a pin that says, you know, I have some data for you, you might want to get the next byte. And another pin that says, well, I've dealt with the data you handed me before, so if you have more bytes to give me, that would be okay. The reason this assignment is interesting, other than some sort of exposure to how register level interaction works, is concurrency. And there are two parts to the concurrency problem, and I'm going to do the assignment in phases, so you're going to look at this code a couple of times. First is really a Kyoto's problem. It's not a fundamental concurrency problem. The problem is this. I need to read bytes, I need to write bytes, but there may be a delay in writing bytes. Right? One of the possibilities in implementing a serial protocol is something called hardware flow control can happen. Hardware flow control is a polite way of saying that the terminal said, shut up! And the wire just won't take any more bytes until the terminal says it's okay. And you don't know how long that will be. There's no bound, in principle, on how long that will be. A bad solution to writing a serial driver will sit in a loop saying, well, until I've actually successfully written the byte, let me try again to write the byte. Because what happens when the other guy says shut up is your serial chip takes a few more characters because it has a little more buffer, and then it says burp, and then it says, well, I can't take any more characters. And it will give you an interrupt when it's ready to take more. But what happens now is behind you, you have a writer, right? Why were you writing this character to the serial chip? Because the writer said, hey, I got 20 characters, you know, they're the prompt line for the bash shell or something like this, and I need them written to the terminal. A party has called you. And another party may call you saying, please give me the next 10 incoming characters. Right? We were doing outgoing characters. Please give me the next 10 incoming characters. Notice, however, here's the process of implementing my serial driver. And I have a writer. And this writer has done a call operation, right? They've done one of these IDL operations, one of these cross-process calls. This operation is blocking and synchronous in its foundational form. So the serial driver will not return until it has completed the operation. At least it's not supposed to. Furthermore, on the server side, and in this call, the serial driver is the server, right? Server is not able to receive another request until it goes into a receiving state again. It generally will not do that until it has completed the current request. And that means that if we have a second process that is the reader, it's going to try to execute a read operation and is going to be unable to do so. The write is not completed. You might ask, why don't I just say, okay, if I can't make more progress on the write, I will go ahead and enter a receive state voluntarily. About what the stack of the serial driver would look like if you did that. Somewhere at the top of the stack, get a receive operation. I got in a buffer of characters from this write request. And I called do write buffer block. And so without replying to the first receive, the proposition was, well, I would call receive again. And I'm going to get a read request. I know that. I might get another write request, but let's assume it's a read request. If I get another write request, we could very easily end up doing our character traffic out of order. Do you see why? Halfway through the 20 bytes that I got in the first receive, I get 30 more. The problem with stacks is you have to unwind them in the reverse order of winding them. Let's assume I got a read. I call do read buffer. You know, the beauty of hardware flow control is it works in both directions. Now my read gets stuck. Anybody tell me a maximum bound on the depth of this stack? Does one exist for this approach to managing it? The good news is the driver is not running in the kernel, and that means you can actually exhaust all of your disk before noticing that you'd run out of memory. But there's a better problem. You really would like to handle write requests in their order of occurrence. You don't want to get halfway through one and then start another, because what you get on the terminal line is scrambled eggs. If you're trying to design puzzles, that might be a great result. So if what came in here was a write request, guess what you have to do? Buffer it. Because you can't start the second write request until the first write request is done. Not if you want to get any sort of consistent output. Anybody tell me an upper bound on the size of the buffer I'd have to maintain? Is there one? In your head. Again, it's either yes or no. There's no bound. I could get a million write requests in, followed by that lonely read request, before the first write request unblocks. Actually, why flow control exists, right, is so that I If somebody tells me to shut up and I turn around to my neighbor and say, look, would you shut up? I'm driving, right? It's a buffer management. That's what flow control is for. So the resolution is we better not enter a receiving state unless we somehow know that it's not for a write, which we can't know.
That hardware, but if you have one write request and that doesn't get over because they don't have access to the serial port?
This process is the one implementing the locking. It hasn't gotten the second request yet. The problem is we don't know what the second request is going to be.
How could the second try have to open access the port, right? I'm going to get trouble when I try to open it.
Why?
I don't want to process.
It doesn't follow, unfortunately. In fact, in Unix, right? If you have create subshells, all of those subshells have the same open file descriptor to the same terminal line. So in daily practice, the example you're putting forward doesn't happen. And they're all doing writes to it in principle at the same time. And there are cases. If you write a background process and start it off, and if you don't explicitly send it standard out to dev null, and you let it write, it will happily spew all over your screen. And if you start typing, the shell you're typing at will also happily spew all over your screen, and you will discover that code gets content gets interspersed. So, yes, if you and I are different parties trying to open the terminal line, we might imagine a locking discipline. That's optional. It's at the discretion of the processes. UUCP got this wrong for years. Okay? But here we're assuming the descriptor's open, and there are multiple parties trying to issue writes, and we want to get some sane order out of them. In this case, in the shell example, there isn't a sane order, right? But the contract in a Unix descriptor, at least, is that there's no guarantee about the order in which writes are handled, but there is a guarantee that one write is handled more or less completely before the next write is allowed to proceed. It might mean terminated prematurely with some subset of bytes having been written, but in a certain sense, we have to let the write operation complete before we can start the next write operation. So the design problem here is, you can't do a bidirect, sorry, Brock?
Yeah, I'm still confused as to why the read is a problem.
I don't know it's a read. It could be a write, in which case we have to buffer it, so that's one problem.
Right, that I got, but I thought you said if it was a read, there was also
the buffer. If both reads and writes are blocked, stop, because we can't take any more until one or the other clears. But if we're not careful, we will proceed to let them clear, and we'll end up with a stack that's infinitely deep because we'll never get back to the one that started the whole mess. Those deeper ones are all going to involve buffering. What we'll do is convert an infinitely deep stack into an infinitely deep buffer. I'm sure if I made that more confusing or less confusing.
All writes and leads to a number of writes, like infinite number, I mean, you can't really.
The answer is, I see. So you're saying at some point we'll just run out of processes, they'll all be blocked and we're done.
Yes, something like that.
Yes, but remember that in this system, the number of processes is bounded by the amount of disk. And if what you say is the case, this is just not the way out of this box. Because even to remember, so imagine that I have 300 gigabytes worth of process structures all queued here.
Sure, but you actually have to buffer it because somebody says.
Right, sure, yeah. We're just pushing the buffer. You're just pushing the buffer around. So what you're proposing is we'll rely on the blocking mechanism not to let those processes enter, and then we don't have to buffer them because we haven't listened, right? That's going to force us to buffer in another place because we need to remember state in order to enqueue those processes. But that reduces it to a previously unsolved problem. If that lets you get to a smaller number of problems, that might be good, but that's not the way out here.
Are we contractually obligated to accept the bytes coming
back? Not until you are ready to process them. But once you accept them, you're obligated to process them.
Oh, so we couldn't do a receive and then reject the write.
Okay, now we're into an interesting design problem. One way out of this is to say, you hand me 20 characters and the contract is I'll make as much progress as I can and I'll tell you how much I made. What's going to happen if we do that problem is we're going to discover busy looping. Because what's the caller going to do? You're going to say, well, you know, I asked for 20, you did 3, I still need the other 17 moves, I'm going to call you back. But I'm the caller, I don't have enough information to know when to call you back. The only guy who has that information is the guy who's looking at the hardware flow control line. Also, if we adopt that protocol, we're going to lose even more of the ordering properties that would be nice to preserve. We could. And that's a very interesting proposition. In this case, it turns out not to be terribly helpful. So it turns out setting up buffers is expensive. There is a cost on the receiver side. Even if you're paying for the buffer and you're providing it to me, I still take some overhead to map that buffer, even remember where I put it. Now, nobody knows how to get rid of that bit of overhead. The Ethernet driver, we're going to do exactly that, and we're going to bound that by putting a limit on the overall number of connections. And that means some people are going to lose. In this case, we don't need to do that. There's really no speed motivation for maintaining buffers here at all in the context of modern processor speed. The idea that we should let parties queue is actually on the right track. The problem here is once we're stuck in a write request, what we would like is we'd like for the write requests to queue, but we'd like the read requests to be able to proceed. So the problem here is we need a queue of writers and also a queue of readers. How are we going to do it? I'm going to introduce a second thread. And the part of the serial driver that does the downward processing, part of the serial driver that does the upward processing, and we're simply going to queue up the requests on different queues.
You say queue, you mean like a process queue, process queue, another queue you're implementing.
In this case, not a queue in the process, yeah. In this case, the queue we're talking about is the queue that is implicit in the caller waiting for the server to receive.
Oh, I'm much relieved now.
Thank you. Now, the thing about concurrency problems is shoving them around doesn't solve them. Actually, this is true about problems in general. You notice this? So the idea is we're going to take two processes and we're going to run them in a common address space. Now, why do they need to be in a common address space? Two reasons. One, register interfaces are primitive wee beasties. What you will discover is the read the next byte operation uses, in some cases, the same registers as the write the next byte operation. And unfortunately, it usually can't be done in a single register operation. For these cheap, cruddy chips, the protocol usually takes the form, hit one register to say what operation you're going to do, and then hit the second register to do the operation. Anybody smells a concurrency problem of the form that we dealt with earlier this morning, you're right. So what's going to happen under the covers is we're going to need to manage this concurrency. So I'm going to organize this assignment in several stages. First is going to be, let's just do the serial driver in one direction, then in the other, ignorant of each other. And then let's look at the concurrency problem. I'll tell you the interesting part about the concurrency problem is that flow control, there are two variants, right? There's the hardware variant where you just can't push more bytes out of the wire. And there's the software variant. And the software variant is really annoying. What the software variant does is it introduces the same problem, exact same problem, at the next level up of abstraction. Because above the down and the up channel at the serial hardware level, there is something called a line discipline. This form of discipline does not generally involve WIPs, chains, and other implements. In a few years. But it does involve data flow in both directions. And so what is the line discipline? When you're typing at a window and you type backspace and a character disappears, that's implemented by the line discipline module. What actually happens is your backspace, which depending on how your keyboard is wired up, maybe a control H or a delete, goes into the line discipline. The line discipline says, oh, control H. I know about control H. What I should do is issue to the stream out channel, right? So this is the in channel driving the out channel. I should issue a control H to move the character backwards. I should print a space to erase whatever character I put there before. And then I should issue another control H to put the cursor where it belongs. They should what?
Update my buffer so when the guy hits return, that's
indeed. Okay, so curious problem. The good news is, so this control H coming in from the keyboard gets interleaved with writes that may be going out, potentially, right? It can. The same concurrency issue that we saw here may happen in the next layer up, but here's the really fun part. Suppose the character you typed was control S. S is the character you type to initiate software flow control. It's scrolling too fast, right? You hit control S, and about a week later it stops, which is why hardware flow control is important. Hardware flow control is much faster. How do you release software flow control, right? So When you hit Control S, the line system says, ah, Control S, I know what to do about that. Down channel. Shut up! Down channel is now in a really interesting state. It is blocked. I've got a whole bunch of writers blocked behind it. What am I blocked waiting for? I'm blocked waiting for the up channel to tell me to proceed. Up channel is going to do that probably when it gets a control cue, but in practice when it gets any character. But here's the point of all this meander. Bidirectional streams are not tricking because they're bidirectional. They're tricking because their control flow and their data flow involves back and forth communication across the channel boundaries. This means that the relationship between the two sides is not a simple relationship. It's a concurrent relationship. And it's not only a concurrent relationship that interacts between the two channels, it's a concurrent relationship that interacts between the two channels and their respective request streams. In particular, I've gotten the control S message, the downside is saying, I will no longer accept requests because I'll no longer accept input because I'm not prepared to do anything with it. And my solution is to block until I'm ready to do something with it. Well, but I'm blocked. And that means that the upside cannot unblock me by calling me because it will block. Hopefully be clearer when I write it up. I wanted you to sort of have seen it once. Now, there are other systems in which we would use signals or we would use, you know, some kind of primitive concurrency management mechanism, or we would use threads and locking. In this system, we don't have any of those. There are no signals in Coyotes. There's no preemptive mechanism of that sort. There are ways to build locking at user level efficiently, but that's not primitively provided. We're going to have to reinvent the mutex concept at application level to make this work. This is actually going to be a multi-stage assignment. I'm going to try to break it down into manageable pieces. And by the time it's all over, you'll have built a serial driver and you'll have built at least a small line discipline module, enough to see where the bodies are buried. And that will take us over quite a period of weeks. It may well stretch through the semester because it's a complicated enough problem that if we break it down in phases, that might not be unreasonable. Normally, if we were doing this in Unix, I would say, now, there's enough documentation out there that this is just a driver problem, we should just deal with it. But in the context of Coyotes, there's the added burden of learning a bit, learning how the Coyotes system works and learning how to apply that to manage this problem. So there's plenty here. Yeah. If you want to, you're certainly welcome to, but in this case, given that I don't have a large supply of PCs to hand out, the intention was to do it with Qemu, which actually does provide an adequate emulation of the serial port hardware. Another option, and you may find that you want to use both because they have different strengths, is to use something called Box, where Qemu does dynamic translation. Box interprets one instruction at a time. And so there's certain kinds of debugging for which Box, while it is much slower, is more informative. In particular, you can get it up to a certain point and say, now I want to see a trace of absolutely every instruction that happens in sequence. That gives you a fighting chance to figure out where the concurrency is going wrong. So anyway, in the process of this, we're going to talk about how do you resolve user-level concurrency efficiently in the primitives of the operating system. We're going to talk about the interlocking issues in dealing with bidirectional streams. And we're going to deal with the joys of line disciplines, unless I decide that that's just too much whipping for one semester, in which case we'll do something else. And I want to say that the Coyotes mechanisms here, not necessarily, I won't say they're exactly the same as other microkernels, but comparable issues exist in most other microkernels. This is a generational issue. So there are microkernels out there that incorporate things like signals. What's useful about signals, actually signals are a lousy design. What's useful about them is that they're preemptive. You don't have preemption, this is a tricky pickle. Their microkernel designs are universally blocking in their primitive operations, and there are reasons for that that seem pretty compelling, and this is sort of the one place where those reasons really get in your way, which makes it a good place to thump and prod and see if any of this makes sense. Okay, let's break for 10 minutes, and we will come back, and I will try to address some other questions that Mr. Dougherty has passed along to me from you.